welcome back to the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian Rowan, writer for the Film Stage. I am joined, as always, by Danny King, another writer for the Film Stage, as well as Nick Newman, the associate editor of the Film Stage. For anyone just joining us, this is how we operate. We will jump into a discussion about a current event topic. In this case, this week, we'll be talking about the Cannes lineup that was released this past week. And then we'll jump into our feature review, which I know we said last week might be The Raid, but is actually going to be God Bless America. So, to kick us off in our discussion about the Cannes lineup that was released, Danny, let's start with you. What do you think about the lineup? Did you notice anything about it? Did it strike you in any way? And then once we've all kind of gotten our general feelings out, we can talk about our most anticipated selections this year.
I was very excited by the lineup. I think one of the consensuses that I read was that it was very heavy on American directors, perhaps more so than in recent years. But to be honest, I'm looking forward to all these movies that were in there from the American directors. And there's also Michael Haneke and several other prominent foreign filmmakers in there too. So I think overall it was a very good lineup.
All right. And Nick, did you have any feelings in particular about just the lineup in general this year?
Well, I think this is one of the best lineups that Cannes has had in the past few years. I think it's even better than last year, because while we had like The Tree of Life and Melancholia playing there, I think that those were like the two big ones. And then after that, there was plenty of quality material, but it just wasn't as prolific, I think. But you look at this list here and you've got Abbas Kiarostami, you've got David Cronenberg, Thomas Vinterberg is there, which is kind of a surprise. Michael Haneke, Christian Mungiu, I believe is how you pronounce it. He directed 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, which is a great film. So yeah, I think it's a pretty terrific lineup overall.
I have to agree. I was really surprised, because usually I'm kind of like you said with last year. There are a couple that I'm really looking forward to, and then the rest are just kind of curiosities. But this year, I would say, you know, the vast majority are things that I've heard about and have been excited about. So I'm really looking forward to hear some of the stuff coming out of there. I know that there had been certain people who expressed not disappointment, but just kind of a sort of vague befuddlement about the underrepresentation of female directors.
Yeah.
And while I can understand that, it's one of those things it's worth bringing up, just because I know that the place of women in popular culture, especially as a creative force, is brought up a lot. I just don't know if there's really anything to say about it. It feels weird to kind of prognosticate a possible reason behind that. Do either of you have an opinion on that?
I guess it's just hard to say, because, you know, we have no idea what kinds of female filmmakers submitted films and got rejected. I think it's just hard to speculate about that. But yeah, I feel like it's worth mentioning, but I don't know how much to say about it.
And are we coming to a point where this might, you know, just beyond mentioning it in passing, is this something that should get addressed a little more proactively? Is it even, like you said, you know, we don't know who submitted what. Is it even possible to address something like this proactively?
I don't know, because, I mean, for me, Cannes has always been the best of the best. I think it's that way for just about everybody. And I don't know, something about if not enough female directors submitted films that are qualified for, you know, if they don't meet Cannes standards, then I don't think they should have been included. I'm not saying that's the case, but I don't think there's some kind of misogyny going on here or anything. I think it's just a matter of what was put in and then what was left out. I think it's that simple.
So that out of the way, I guess we should get into our most anticipated. We know there's a huge crop that's coming in, and a lot of them look really good. But I'd like to get, you know, 3 or 5 of your most anticipated films this year. So, Nick, how about we start with you?
Okay. I don't have a specific order for this, just because I'm looking forward to all these movies, so to rank them in this fashion feels a little arbitrary.
Yeah,
so.
No, ranking is completely unnecessary, because I think it would be, without even seeing them, you know, it's kind of hard to tell. I think we can all just agree that we're really, really hyped about what's coming out, so don't worry about that.
Yeah, so if I had to pick 5, Like Someone in Love from Abbas Kiarostami, that might be the top, actually, because I'm a big fan of his. And then there's Amour from Michael Haneke, and I'm also looking forward to Rust and Bone from Jacques Audiard, and then there is Beyond the Hills by the aforementioned Christian Mungiu, and Cosmopolis from David Cronenberg.
And Danny, how do you feel about his list, and what about your own?
So we definitely have a couple of crossovers there. Making my 5 would also be Amour and Rust and Bone, the two foreign films that are in my top 5 right now. One that we were mentioning, how there's such a widespread amount of films that we've been hearing about for a while. So that's one of the reasons why The Paperboy is kind of very interesting to me, which is Lee Daniels' follow up to Precious, because it's just really strange to me that a movie with a director like that, and it has a very populated cast with big names, and I just feel like I've heard nothing about it. That's one of the reasons why I'm really interested in that. I also have Cosmopolis up there. The trailers for that have been just off the walls. And then Andrew Dominik's Killing Them Softly.
You know, your last one, Killing Them Softly, is definitely one of mine. I've been a huge fan of Andrew Dominik, and I've kind of been eagerly awaiting his next. Also, Like Someone in Love by Abbas Kiarostami. That's, oddly enough, you know, looking at mine, it's kind of weird. That's really the only kind of foreign one that I have, unless you count The Angel's Share with Ken Loach. I'm really excited about that for a number of reasons, and one of them is just the fact that it has to do with distilling whiskey. I've dabbled in distilling. I have a friend who's very much into distilling, and it's one of those things where it's just, you know, the perfect subject matter and audience for me anyway. And Loach is also a very good director, so I'm just always eager to see something that he's done. Again, Cosmopolis on the top of my list, probably, except for my other pick, which we'll get into in a second. I think, like a lot of people, Cosmopolis wasn't really on my radar until the first trailer came out. And it was at that point that a lot of us kind of just got, I guess, shocked into suddenly realizing that this was a movie that was coming out and that it looked kind of, you know, good old-fashioned Cronenberg insane. Yeah. I actually just got the book, so I'm hoping to read it before any of the reviews come out, just so I can get that going. And on that same subject of reading a book before seeing a movie, I am really looking forward to Lawless by John Hillcoat. I loved The Proposition. It's one of my go-to films. You know, if I have a rainy day and, you know, there's nothing new out, I'll pop in The Proposition, because it's
the one film in the world where somebody gets shot in the head while they're in the middle of raping somebody.
Yeah. So that it, like, one of the things that I love about him, and this is, you know, maybe a strange thing to like about a director, he's not interested so much in violence as the repercussions of violence. A lot of people said that he made a, you know, film that maybe kind of glorified violence with The Proposition. I think it did the opposite, because it's just so brutal and the aftermath of everything is really intense, and it,
yeah.
And given the subject matter of Lawless, I'm reading the book, The Wettest County in the World. There is a lot of emphasis on that, because it's about, you know, moonshine runners in Prohibition and post-Prohibition Virginia. And, you know, a lot of what they do is violence and the way that the violence impacts their industry. The Road, I admired probably more than I liked it, but I love Hillcoat. I think he's a really talented director, and I really like the story, as far as I've gotten into it, that Lawless is based off of. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, I have to say, like, I had a Proposition, but The Road I was very let down by, partially because I'm one of those assholes who's like, oh, the book is so much better.
Well,
but
yeah, the book is a lot better.
the book is so much better. But I don't
know.
That's
a problem with a lot of McCarthy's work, though. So I kind of gave him a buy on that.
Yeah, the thing is, like, The Proposition is so good, and it's not that The Road is a bad film, it's just kind of bland, but I feel like maybe that's more a problem where he tried to adapt the book literally, as opposed to, he tried to do, like, a literal adaptation, not a more creative do-your-own thing. So I feel like with Lawless, as it's now called, it seems like very different source material than The Road, you know?
Yes,
it seems a lot more straightforward.
Yeah, I was about to say, The Road was very episodic. It was more of a mood piece. And just from what I've read, I'm about halfway into the novel. This is a much more plot-driven, you know, there are stakes and there are characters and there are ideas going on. One of my things was, I was going to say, I felt like maybe some people wouldn't be looking forward to Lawless so much because their only exposure might have been The Road. I don't know about that, but I'm really looking forward to it. So it's on my list because I love John Hillcoat. So now that we've got that out of the way, unless anyone has any last things they'd like to say about Cannes this year?
I wish I was going.
Yeah. Just one of the things I noticed while you're mentioning the Wettest County book is it's just been interesting to track some of these title changes lately. Killing Them Softly was previously Kogan's Trade, and then like the Woody Allen movie.
Yeah, Woody Allen's movies had like three different titles, wasn't it?
And like, I don't know if there's much to interpret from it, but it's just something that's been popping up recently a lot.
Yeah, it has been popping up. And I was actually a little upset that they changed it from first The Wettest County in the World to just The Wettest County and then to Lawless.
Yeah.
Because they actually, they asked Malick's permission, I guess, and he gave it to them because Malick was initially making his Austin, you know, music scene-centric film, and it was called Lawless. And I think I tweeted something out like, you know, Lawless about musicians is enigmatic and interesting. Lawless about gangsters is pretty simple and straightforward. They did it with The Raid. They changed it to The Raid Redemption.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. It's something that's been popping up. I don't know if there's much to read into it other than just, you know, people were postulating that the raid will be turned into a series. I think that might have been the original intent, but they just want to add the subtitle.
Well, that's the reason for the title change, because yeah. There's going to be the Red Redemption, and then there actually is a title for the second. I could look that up right now, but that is very much something they did with the future in mind.
Yeah.
It's still a stupid title, but at least there's a purpose behind it.
There was a little bit of redemption in the film. I would have gone with the raid, you know, crazy mayhem. Yeah, it seems like it's mainly marketing decisions. You know, maybe they thought the Wettest County was a little bit of an obscure title.
Yeah.
And they just wanted to simple it up for people.
The sequel is called The Raid Retaliation.
Okay. Oh, that's right. Gosh.
So.
This is another thing, and this is weird. Every sequel or subtitle that's a single noun, it always starts with an R. Does anyone else notice that? I don't even know, like,
Revenge
of
Fallen.
Yeah, like, and then just the Raid Redemption, the Raid Retaliation. You know, there was Red Dead Redemption. Like, there's just some thing where it's like, it's got to be an R. Must be an R. And I don't know why.
Never noticed that.
Well, now that I've said it, you're never going to be able to stop noticing it. So I apologize for destroying things for you forever. But it is out there, and it's weird. Like the three Matrix films, it was Reloaded and then Revolutions.
Yes.
If you all notice any other R-subtitled films, you can feel free to send that in to us. You can actually contact us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. I welcome them because I just want to be proven right. So that out of the way, we can now move on to our featured review, which will be of Bobcat Goldthwait's God Bless America.
My name is Chloe. I live in Virginia Beach, and everyone loves me because I'm so pretty.
I wanted an Escalade! This is the biggest day of my life, and I'm doing all the work!
Don't move and don't make a sound.
If you want the car, just take it. My parents got me the wrong one anyways.
Yeah, that's a tragedy.
Did you just kill Chloe?
Awesome. That was a fantastic start.
You take requests. Who are you killing next?
The Kardashians.
People who use rock star as an adjective.
People who give high fives.
Anyone who wears crystals.
You're friggin' Rambo, man.
Okay, that was a clip from the trailer for God Bless America. This film follows the fortunes of Frank, who is diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor, and decides to take it upon himself to rid the country of the elements that he believes are making this a worse world to live in, and he is joined at some point by Roxy, played by Tara Lynn Barr, who claims to come from a trailer park background with an abusive father and a crack whore mother, who aids him in his killing spree. This is a film that's on video on demand and iTunes at the moment. I believe it's getting a limited theatrical release in a week or two. So we're gonna dive into this. This is a film that I feel like will either just hit you kind of like a wet blanket and you're not gonna really care, or you might, you know, get some strong reaction from it. So we'll see how we felt. Danny, how about we start with you? What were your initial thoughts on God Bless America?
I was really into this movie kind of from the beginning. I think that I made a point of rewatching World's Greatest Dad before I saw this. I think that movie is maybe like a tighter script. I don't think there's any real fat on it. I kind of was interested in how uneven God Bless America was, and it seems to just wander at times. There's a scene at the beginning where this main character is just flipping through the channels. It's like two or three channels go by, and there are these, you know, mindless reality shows, and it's like, okay, we get the point of the scene. Like, TV is annoying, and it's just turning into these reality shows. But the scene goes on for like almost maybe 7 or 8 minutes, and that just like, it was so interesting. And I think that, you know, eventually this supporting character comes in, who's this girl. And I think that maybe her role is a bit of a mixed blessing, because she does have this really kind of sweet relationship with this guy. But also these scenes at the beginning where it's just him alone, I was so interested by it. And then by the end, it kind of gets a little bit plotty for me. But overall, I think that I just love the point of view of the movie, and just what it was making fun of worked really well for me.
All right, and Nick, how did you feel about God Bless America?
Funny you'd use the word initial when asking Danny, because when this film started, I thought the first like 10 minutes were like objectively bad. really, really terrible. Just, it kind of looked like a Chappelle Show skit almost, like the cinematography and the acting and the direction. It didn't feel like a movie, but then just something happened where eventually I started going with it. And once I was on board, I really enjoyed it. I think that the movie is very on the nose, but part of me thinks it's almost one of the points of it, because this isn't something you can necessarily be subtle about. And I was also really, really impressed by Noel Murray's performance. I'd only seen him as Freddie Rumsen on Mad Men, where he played a very similar character, but he has like the perfect face for this kind of guy, the sad sack. And the way he carries himself is just so particular, and it matches his character wonderfully. And I would say that even though the movie has a lot of rough edges, I found that by the end I sort of respected what the movie was doing more than maybe I actually liked it. But overall, it is a film that I did enjoy.
I think that if I were to take, this is going to sound a lot meaner than I mean it to, if I were to take the worst parts of everything you felt about this movie, from the weird Chappelle Show-esque cinematography and opening to the kind of plotting, meandering ending, then you would have my perfect summation of this film. I admired what it was trying to do. I felt like a lot of the reality TV shows they kind of invented for this were like uncomfortably on the nose as in terms of reflecting what's actually out there. There are a couple of really twisted things that happen on there on those shows, and I can't even say whether or not that hasn't already happened. So it was one of those things where it's like, this is going too far. Oh, wait a second. No, it's not. This is stuff that's occurred. I just feel like as good as Joel Murray is in this, there's just kind of this uncertainty to what his real mission is. As far as I was concerned, he has this repeated line where it's just like, why do you have to be so mean? But it doesn't even feel like he's just going against that in particular. So his whole vendetta is kind of a little muddled for me. Tara Lynn Barr as his sidekick, Roxy.
I think she's great.
She was great. She was great with a frankly kind of thankless role, I feel. She was kind of the more id-based lip side to Joel's character of Frank. And I just, like, there was a point when she was first introduced where I was like, if I'm supposed to like this person, then it's failing. And then I kind of got into the groove with her. But then, again, you know, as much as this movie rails against mean people, it just felt really kind of mean itself. And as much as it said we like simplify and project, it was simplifying and projecting. And while maybe that was the point, I felt like that kind of blunted the point that it was trying to make. So I don't know. I didn't hate it. I much preferred, World's Greatest Dad. That was an incredible film. I really enjoyed that. Robin Williams gave a great performance in that. And I felt that it was a little more astute and a little less just like, you know, your half drunk best friend, you know, complaining at you after, you know, you forced him to watch Jersey Shore once. Yeah, I don't know. Am I wrong?
I think you point out something, and Nick mentioned this too, with how on the nose the film is there's something about the satire of this film that's very literal. And I found that interesting. There's a scene where he's in his car just listening to the radio, and just him listening to the radio works as satire because you don't need to do anything creative or heightened or abstract to satirize what the movie is going after. And I found that interesting. Whereas World's Greatest Dad, is the satire in that is a little bit, like you said, more astute. And so I think one of the things that will divide people on God Bless America is whether or not the kind of like reality show insistence stuff wears too much on them or not.
Yeah, and that's kind of my thing, as there was a point when I was asking myself, like, well, what could the movie have done? Mm-hmm. To kind of just, you know, it seemed like, like you said, that I said, a little too on the nose. It was right there. But there's not much you can do when we've already gone kind of this far. And so I think that the movie had that working against it, and I think it did an admirable job of trying to go further than that with Joel's eventual kind of homicidal rebellion against society. But I mean, even insofar as the things that he's complaining about, I feel like it's kind of curmudgeon-y. I mean, if you look back, a lot of the things that he's complaining about are things that people have been complaining about for a long time. I mean, if you look at, I think we were talking about, you know, Cormac McCarthy earlier in the film No Country for Old Men. Tommy Lee Jones's character thinks that everything that he's seeing is, you know, the beginning of the end of society, and that film takes place in the 80s, and there's a character that tells him, you know, what you got ain't new, and it ain't all coming for you, and that's vanity. And I kind of felt like this movie was a perfect exploration of that, because he keeps saying that, like, we've never been worse, but I feel like everyone thinks that. So there's little...
I would say that you also have to consider he's kind of at his breaking point, and I think maybe it's an issue of everything is just becoming more pronounced because his life is going downhill. Because you see, like, the scenes where he's sitting in front of his TV, and, like, he has his awful neighbors, and his kid doesn't want to talk to him, and he's lost his job. I think that those need to be taken into consideration in the sense that it becomes more noticeable when it's starting to affect you personally, or you, at least you feel like it's affecting you personally. And, you know, you talk about like No Country for Old Men. That's a different stance that's being taken. Not a different stance, but it's from a different viewpoint. And the viewpoint here is one that's of a guy who's downbeaten.
Yeah, and I understand that. And it's one of the, it's a film where it feels kind of hard to tell what is character and what is creator, if that makes any sense. It feels like a lot of the things that are getting spoken are just kind of, it almost felt like excerpts from a stand-up act.
Yeah, he has that rant kind of early on that goes on.
Yeah, it's like a five-minute rant.
It's another one of these scenes where you think it's going to be like kind of one or two lines about where society's gone, and he just goes on forever. And then it's just, it was so uneven and weird. I don't know.
Yeah, that was something that got on me a lot in this film, too, is it seemed like a lot of it was just set up for him to just talk at length about what he didn't like. And then when the little girl, well, little girl, she's a teenager, when she comes in, it becomes even worse because suddenly, you know, she's the kind of foil that doesn't have to try to be a sympathetic person. So she doesn't have to contextualize everything with, you know, oh, you know, this isn't political. This is just about being nice and, you know, not being so cynical and angry. But she can come in and just be like, no, screw that. You know, these people are wrong. You know, their politics are wrong. And as much as, you know, it kind of shows him pushing back against that, there's never a real moment where he says to her, you know, you're part of the problem. And I was actually expecting that to some extent, but it never happened.
Yeah, you mentioned the politics part. And to me, that whole kind of subplot with the Bill O'Reilly-esque anchor, I suppose, that just didn't work. And that's also the line you mentioned before where he's like, why do you have to be so angry? I feel like, or why do you have to be so mean? Just none of that portion of the movie worked for me. It kind of threw me off for like the middle, maybe half hour or something, because that it started to get really political for a few scenes, and that just felt like out of nowhere.
Yeah, because a movie like this that seems to be trying to make these points about, you know, popular culture, I mean, obviously politics plays into it. We're a very politically engaged society now because we have so much access to information. But like you said, it just kind of takes you out of the movie and it really knocks you off base. And what was once a sweeping commentary about society in general suddenly feels like it's just taking pot shots against certain people. This is another problem I had with the little girl. At some point, she says she just wants to kill all NASCAR fans.
Yeah, and like Diablo Cody.
Yeah, I'm fine with Diablo Cody. It was the NASCAR fans that, because it just, this is one of those things I'll never understand. NASCAR fans seem to take a lot of flack, and I don't quite understand why. I don't feel like watching cars, you know, run in a circle is any less, you know, compelling than, you know, playing Little Big Planet. Like, it just it's just an escape, and I don't know why you have to be demeaning towards it. And again, like, if the movie had just addressed, you know, people who take sports too seriously in general, that would have been, you know, it's something else that you can kind of say, okay, these are people who arbitrarily pick a reason to be hateful towards other people, or they're investing all of their energy in something that doesn't matter. But in this case, it was literally just NASCAR fans. And I should say now, I don't like NASCAR, but I don't particularly hate its fans either. And there were just moments.
But don't you think
like
that's sort of counterbalanced?
It does. Can you expand on that before I guess, respond?
Well, during that very scene, I mean, Frank is trying to, you know, in that scene, Frank is telling her, you can't just kill people that you don't like. I think the movie is very much against the idea of going after anybody who annoys you, because you look at the people that he kills, and there are certain social ramifications behind their deaths. You know, there are people who are in the public eye who can leave some kind of negative impact. And during that scene, he basically says that those aren't people who are going to change the world for the worst. So I don't know if the movie is problematic on that level, necessarily.
Yeah, and I do understand that. And like I said, you know, Frank does kind of butt up against her, but it feels like she's almost an insert character that allows the director and writer to take more pot shots than he thought he could get away with by just trying to stick to his, you know, apolitical kind of libertarian, can't we all just get along message. And I never felt like there was enough of a backlash against her to really make me believe that that wasn't something that was actually meant, if that makes sense.
I guess. To me, it feels like Frank is the mouthpiece for Bobcat Goldthwait, and then maybe it's the mouthpiece for his more sensible side.
Mm-hmm.
And then Roxy is kind of him losing his head in a way. But obviously, one comes out over the other.
Yeah.
So I don't see that as being a big problem.
Yeah, and it wasn't a movie killer for me, but it was something, you know, like Danny was saying, where it just kind of takes you out for a second. That, in addition to the kind of, you know, speechifying beyond the point where you've made your point, a lot of the talking in this movie goes on for a long time. But I mean, beyond that, the only other thing I can really say against it is just that even though this movie is recent, it hasn't even hit theaters yet. I think it was screened like a year ago, but it felt really dated, which I think is just a problem that most movies that try to deal with pop culture nowadays are going to have trouble with.
How so? Like, how was it dated?
I mean, just like it was, you know, a great one of the through strain plot points was a William Hung reference. And that was a while ago. I had meant to write down more. Unfortunately, I think that I neglected to. But there were just moments where it was talking about things that just kind of, it felt like it was written 5 years ago and produced maybe not three or four years ago, but like a year or two ago, and then it's seeing light of day now, and so some of those things aren't as topical as you would have thought they would have been. Luckily for him, a lot of the most annoying aspects of society continue to persist. So the attack on the substitute Westboro Baptist Church was just as gleefully, sadistically fulfilling as he probably intended it to be. So things like that worked. The William Hung kind of subplot kind of left me cold.
I think that I have, like, from multiple people, I've heard that the kind of American Idol parody stuff felt dated for them. And my reaction to that was, I just think that American Idol might have been the first kind of big reality show to usher in these types of shows where people audition, half of them are talented, half of them get made fun of. So maybe he was just trying to reference the origins of it. And I don't know enough about reality TV to know if American Idol was the first big thing, but I feel like that might have been an intention.
Yeah, and like I understand that, but again, it's just, for me, it kind of took me out a bit. And again, yeah, like I said, not a deal killer. It wasn't something that really destroyed anything for me. But there were times when I was just like, William Hung was on Arrested Development, like that was a while ago. We should have chosen something a little more current. Though that probably was, you know, the biggest and most easily accessible reference to make without alienating people, you know, like you and me, who aren't really followers of reality television.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm going to arbitrarily say, because again, this isn't a movie that really contains spoilers. In fact, a lot of the kill moments are in the trailer.
Yeah,
I was actually surprised. I thought that it would be much more of a bloodbath than it was, but a lot of those kind of, you know, punctuated with a bullet moments were in the trailer. So, as arbitrary as this may sound, we're going to get into spoilers now. Does anyone have anything to say before we, you know, kind of draw a line in the sand?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I would just say I feel like this might have been a step back for Bobcat Goldthwait as a filmmaker, because it feels a lot less polished than World's Greatest Dad.
I definitely agree. Yeah.
Not just in terms of like the cinematography, obviously, that's something I brought up. That's not necessarily him, but that is something he has a say over. And also, I don't know, even in terms of just the way it's shot, it felt much more like a TV production than a film, because World's Greatest Dad was actually fairly cinematic, I would argue, whereas doesn't necessarily... It's fitting that I saw this on VOD, because it felt like... It just almost like something that would be on Showtime.
Yeah, and well, funny you say Showtime, because Joel Murray is in was in the first season of Shameless, playing a character that's vaguely similar, you know, has a lot of problems with society and the way things are going. If I had seen this in a theater, I think I might have been kind of disappointed. It probably did help that I was able to see it on VOD, because I feel like the flaws that we're mentioning, you know, the kind of stagey aspect of the beginning, and especially towards the conclusion that... And this isn't a spoiler to say it. It feels like it was filmed in an elementary school auditorium.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to mention the scale.
Things like that would probably take me out of it if I was watching it on, you know, a 200-foot screen. But on a computer monitor, not so much. So I think that it definitely played in the movie's favor. But that being said, we're going to get into spoilers now. So if you haven't seen this film, you know, go out and it's worth $10, I would say. You know, get some friends together. Scrape your change together. Give it a look. That's about as much as I can say for it. You know, if it was in limited release, I would say that it's not worth looking up. But since it's so easily accessible, I'm going to say go for it. Nick and Danny, like, you know, what's your opinion? Go for it. Skip it. See World's Greatest Dad instead.
Yeah, if you're curious, I would say it's definitely worth the money required. But if you're only vaguely interested, maybe wait to rent it from Netflix.
I feel like I maybe like it the most just because I agree with what both of you guys have said in terms of like flaw aspects, but so much of the point of view of this movie is just so cathartic to me while I was watching it. I just kind of had a lot of fun.
So, vague recommendation. Now we're going into spoilers. So, spoiler alert. The way that this movie ends, for me at least, it felt a little hackneyed and didn't make a lot of sense. Just insofar as the way that they work the relationship with Roxy's character, because he finds out that she lied to him about, you know, her trailer park life and getting raped, which I saw coming a mile away.
I remember when she said that line and I was just like, that doesn't seem right.
Yeah,
I thought she was joking.
I thought she was joking actually. Too. And then he was just like, oh, really? That sucks. And she was like, yeah, it's terrible. And I was like, oh, wait. I was wondering if she... There was a point when I said, like, that wasn't a very convincing line. I wonder if she meant for it to be not convincing and then was surprised that he believed it. I don't know.
Yeah, that's kind of a strange device.
Yeah. And then, you know, he gets mad because she lied to him. And so he sends her home and there's that scene where she's with her family. And then suddenly she's in Hollywood from Virginia, where she just had a very public reconciliation with her family. And she somehow broke into the American Superstars with a Z finale and is going to help him take out some people. And, you know, at some point, the William Hung character says that the reason he tried to take his own life wasn't because he was upset that he was being made fun of, but because he was worried about his fame declining. And then he just looks at her and says, you know, you're a pretty girl. And then they start taking him out. What do you think that was trying to say? Because he had a point earlier where he very much, you know, danced around ever saying anything about her in that way. So for me, you know, he seemed to take this very moral stance on it. And then the second he realizes that he's going to die, he's just like, screw it. You know, does the little thing that he said he would never do, which is, you know, objectifying her or looking at her in that way, and then starts shooting a place up. Does anyone have a read on that?
I don't think he was objectifying her. I think he knew exactly what was going to happen, so he figured that he would just kind of give in on this one thing, and because what else is he going to do? They're about to die anyway. So I think it's just one of those last moment lines, if you will.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like it was a screw it moment combined with like an actual sincere kind of line.
I definitely think it's sincere.
Yeah.
No, I don't doubt his sincerity. It just seems weird that he made, you know, even beyond, you know, any kind of romantic thing, he made such a big deal about it earlier, and then he just reversed himself. I mean, like, was that for her benefit? Was it for his benefit? It just was one of these moments that kind of confused me, because they devoted an entire scene to his not saying it.
Yeah.
And the only takeaway from that scene was he doesn't want to be like everyone else and like making this connection to, you know, children and, you know, any kind of sexuality. He brought up Woody Allen, you know, he brought up the Bratz dolls. And now suddenly when the chips are down, he's going to just change that. Maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm the only person.
I didn't read it as like a total reversal, just in the sense that there's like a big difference between what he's saying about Woody Allen and him just telling this girl that he thinks she's pretty. I don't know. It felt much more sincere and like just right than it did like he was reversing his morals.
And don't you think there's something significant about the fact that it's the end of their journey? Because he had just met her when that scene happens. And then think about all they went through between that point and the very end. Yeah. So,
yeah, if there is one thing to say for this film, actually, it is that they develop the relationship between those two people very well. Frank and Roxy become a pretty good compatible, not couple, because they pretty much rail against that, but just a good team. And there's the scene when they're talking about who they'd like to kill, and they have a fake mustache on, and they're playing the Russian roulette game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, moments like that I really enjoyed, and it did make me feel, you know, like they were actually bonding as a pair. I don't know, it was just like I said, at that moment when he turns and says that, it did have the feeling of something that was supposed to have more meaning than I felt the movie gave it, but that's just me. Was the ending kind of what you figured it would be? Did it do anything that surprised you specifically, or was it another one of those things where you could kind of see it coming, but it was nice to have anyway? Specifically, I guess, with the William Hung character.
I didn't necessarily see that one coming, but I saw the big ending coming, I think. There's one line where Bonnie and Clyde is mentioned, and I was just like, okay, that's probably where we're going.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
And I didn't really think it was ever going to end any other way.
Yeah, I don't think it could end any other way, because the movie's message would be a little confused if they got away with it, I think.
This is something else that I felt kind of weird about. Does it matter to any of you at all that they come up with this reason for him to stop caring, which is that he has a brain tumor, and then they just kind of get rid of that. Did it seem like at that point, did they really need to have that plot point to drive him in, and then did they need to take it away?
Well, it's what sets him off, I think. It's what pushes him over the edge. But I do agree that maybe when you find out that he doesn't have a brain tumor, there should be some more impact there. Like, he should maybe feel a little more guilt or second guess his own actions. But there isn't a lot of that. He doesn't change that much after that point, which I thought was kind of odd.
Yeah, I was expecting something. I can't really say what. You know, I'm not going to expect him to put the gun away and say, oh man, that was a big mistake, and then just go home. But I was expecting something. Like, maybe instead of becoming a destructive force, he'd become a creative force trying to better the world, not through elimination, but through the construction of something better. But that didn't happen. And just to me, it felt like if you were going to do that, if you were just going to take away that kind of fatalistic, you know, side of this, you could have just not put it in to begin with and found another way to push him over. Because honestly, his life was pretty unhappy to begin with. I feel like it wouldn't have taken that much to get him to go where he went. Yeah, Danny, did you have any opinion about the whole...
Yeah, I mean, that's just another example of the subplotting of this movie, just feeling really confused. And that's, I kind of just tried to forget about that stuff. Like, there's one moment late in the movie where he's walking through the backstage. He walks by this one news anchor who's like really annoying, and he just shoots him right there. And that image kind of like defines what I liked about the movie. Just this kind of like, screw it, I'm gonna just end this right now. But like all the other stuff, the doctor thing, her confused background with the rape line, that stuff, I kind of just like fell through the walls for me.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. This is something I wanted to bring up because, you know, you say he walks through the halls and then he shoots the guy. Isn't that the point where the police should have shown up?
That was very illogical, the final scene.
There's another point, because at first I was like, oh my God, like this is when like things are gonna get heavy now. But instead, things continue on as usual. Mm-hmm. There was another point that was kind of like that, where he's in the backstage area and a guy comes over and says you can't be here, and he shoots him. And if you look, there's another guy like 20 feet back working at a soundboard who just does not seem to notice that a guy just got shot like 20 feet away from him. For me, that was another thing that kind of made me feel like this wasn't as cinematic as it should have been. A little thing
logical.
Like that. Yeah, it was like a very first draft feeling.
And one of the things that bugged me even more about that is, like, I feel like at the beginning it was trying to be maybe semi-realistic, like the scene where he kills Chloe.
Oh yeah, Chloe.
It's like he's really faulty, like he messes up and then he ends up panicking and just shoots her. And I was like, okay, this might be interesting to see like how much killing he can actually pull off in a realistic way. But
yeah,
by the end, it kind of drops that. And like even the final minute, they manage to shoot around 30 people before they get shot themselves. Kind of just released all abandon or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a shame because I remember when he puts like the rag in the gas tank and he lights on a fire. I was thinking, really? They're going to do that? That seems to go against what the movie's leaning toward. And then when the camera reveals that the rag is just lying on the floor burning, like that was so perfect. And then at the end, it almost transforms into that kind of movie. And the problem for me is I would love it if there was kind of like this... I think a big problem is that the movie doesn't heighten itself as it goes along. It kind of stays on that same wavelength. And then in the last scene, it decides to expand its own reality and reach out in this fashion, but there's no buildup to it. It's just kind of how the film ends, you know? There's this big shootout, which makes no sense whatsoever. And then it literally ends the second they die, which I like, but I don't know. It turns into like a cartoon at the end, which is what the movie almost seemed to be going against for a long time.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I likened that scene with the car and the flaming rag that gets blown out to the Boondock Saints. Their initial, you know, they have the first kill that was, you know, kind of motivated by necessity. But then their first attempt to really go out there and try to do something, they get lost in an air duct and they get tangled in ropes. And it's really just through sheer happenstance that they wind up actually being successful. And
yeah, it's a much better film than the Boondock Saints, though. Let's be realistic.
It is, but at the same time, you know, it's like normal people going out and killing people. And I just liked that that I appreciate that idea of someone who, by all accounts, should not be good at this, you know, screwing up but somehow making it happen anyway, because I feel like that's a lot of what would happen in reality, and finding the humor in that, like that scene with the car and the reg, that was one of the few times where I felt like I really got a laugh out of this movie instead of just kind of a cool feeling of, yeah, that would be awesome if someone did that. And like you said, that final scene, it's just kind of, it's you know, a cartoon. It doesn't feel true to the rest of the movie, and I feel like ending it with them just dying and then not even showing anything after that, it's an okay choice. I feel like they could have perhaps gone another scene and just kind of shown if there was any impact, because at this point, you know, there's a sea of dead people, and these two have died, and they've made their point, but for a movie that seems to be discussing society in general, it feels like there should be something else.
And one of the things that actually connects this movie to World's Greatest Dad is how we like glorify people that die, in the sense that the politician ends up becoming a martyr through the media, and then World's Greatest Dad is obviously all about how society perceives dead people. So I guess it could have been interesting to see how the media would have responded to the final shootout, but that would have felt maybe like from a different movie.
Yeah, I agree, but again, just because there are moments where he does look at the coverage of what he's doing. There's a point where he kills a bunch of people in a movie theater, and the news anchor postulates that it could be because they were watching a violent film, and he says that no one takes responsibility anymore. They're always looking to pass the buck. But then the girl who he let live in the theater, because she was actually quiet and courteous, you know, says that they deserved it because, you know, they were being loud and obnoxious. But it's just another thing where you have those two things happen, but the movie never does anything with it. It just kind of occurs and then is left to sit out there like a fish on the ocean. I don't even have a good analogy for it, because it really felt like it was building up to a point where something on a social scale would occur, but nothing ever did. And maybe that was the point. Maybe he did actually have absolutely no impact, but it would have been nice to just get at least a little more of a hint that it was either fruitless or it did something. You know, you said it might,
but it's more a personal journey.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It is, but at the same time, like, they're talking about society and they're trying to affect it in some way. And to just have these weird moments, like when he throws her phone out of the car because she's trying to find news on them, I thought that was an effective way to say, we're not going to care about, you know, the social repercussions of this because it is just our personal journey. But then they immediately start going to news clips in other places, and, you know, the guy becomes a martyr. You know, the news anchor says that a violent movie may have caused it. And it felt like from then on, it was going to actually give a context to everything that was happening, but that never panned out. So it was another one of those things where the writing felt a little loose, like it was trying to say something and it was going to go a direction, but then it goes in another direction.
Yeah, I guess that's just an inherent tension in this movie, because while it is clearly a personal journey for the characters, the movie is very obviously trying to comment on society, so balancing those two is kind of tricky.
And just speaking about society, before we get into closing this up, this movie is called God Bless America. They obviously are very critical of American society, and they almost start to deify France's society. Not coming from another society, I can't really say, but do you think that it's fair to kind of land all of this in the lap of a single country, especially given how much of a global society we're starting to form?
I think it's fair, because everything he's watching is on American television. And, you know, he talks about society, but he doesn't seem like someone who has much exposure to foreign cultures. So I think that's an issue of his own viewpoint and his own exposure.
Danny, any thoughts?
Yeah, I kind of agree, but I could see where you could make that criticism, but it's not something that kind of bugged me while I was watching it. French society does feel like a bit of a random deification, but...
Though I will say that in every French movie I've ever watched, the people live in houses that just have walls that are filled with books. It's something I noticed when I was watching Goodbye First Love, and I realized that in every French film, the houses look like libraries. The only reason I have a criticism about this is because I was trying to think, you know, maybe he's right, but then I came to the recollection of, and of course I can't remember her name now. Do you remember the woman on UK's Got Talent, or Britain's Got Talent?
Oh, Susan Boyle.
Yeah, Susan Boyle. The way that was framed was, you know, she's this frumpy woman from out in the country who's come to this thing, and the entire lead up to her actually taking stage and singing was, You know, the two hosts backstage were kind of making fun of her, and everyone in the crowd was laughing, and the judges were kind of having a go at it too, and then she starts singing, and suddenly everyone's on her side again. That felt pretty much to me like how most of American Idol goes. And I know that Britain's Got Talent came out before America's Got Talent. And, you know, Simon Cowell is British. Like, things like that just kind of, it gave me a pause. Because it's like, you know, America obviously has this problem. We, you know, you can't get Jersey Shore anywhere else. But, you know, we've imported some of our cruelty, it feels. And it feels, you know, I might have been asking too much for it to look into that. But it's something that I thought about and I thought I'd bring up.
I think that's a legitimate point. But yeah, I think it would have been just asking the scope of this movie to try and do more than it's already trying to do, which might already be more than enough in a sense.
Nick, did you have anything to say about that?
Maybe it's an issue of the fact that the movie scope is so limited. Is that possible?
It's possible. And like I said, you know, it might be asking too much of this movie to branch out and look at the way things here affect people in Namibia, but it just was something that just stuck in my head and I felt was worth mentioning.
No, it's a fair point.
That said, I think I've run out of things to say about God Bless America. Does anyone have any final comments they'd like to make?
I just feel kind of weird how I've been pointing out little things about this movie I didn't like, because I did like the movie overall. I just think that it's scattershot, and so not everything's going to stick. And it's really an issue of the fact that what doesn't stick really felt pronounced to me. But overall, I did admire it. I think that it's a smart film and it has, you know, it has legitimate things to say.
Danny, any last?
I kind of feel the same way as Nick in the sense that I've been pointing out a lot of details that bugged me, but I did. The impression I'll leave with from this movie is just this point of view of a guy just saying screw it to what's around him, and I think that's something that I really enjoyed and will stick with me for a little bit.
Yeah, this movie definitely for me does have that same level of wish fulfillment. You know, we all wish every once in a while we could just put someone's head through a wall, and this movie definitely helps you out with that. If you're not on its political wavelength at times, you're probably going to get offended, but this isn't a movie that seeks to play it safe, so I think that that's perfectly fine. And yeah, I mean, I gave it a lot of grief, but I enjoyed it as well. And as I said, I think it's perfectly well done and worth your while. So now that we've come to the end of that discussion, it's time to give a brief look ahead and see what's coming out next week and give our best bets for what you should probably check out. So yeah, I guess this is a grab bag. Whoever has something to say, you can just come out and say it.
There's a Juliette Binoche movie called Owls that is coming out in limited release, I think. I saw that a couple weeks ago, and I'll be writing a review of it. But it's kind of, it feels like a little bit, it's NC-17, and there's a lot of nudity, graphic sex scenes in it. So just, it's kind of funny how it's coming out in the wake of something like Shame, but it's kind of a mediocre movie, which is really, it's really well made, but the storyline is just very confused kind of and not interesting, but it's something that may stir up controversy a little bit.
All right. And Nick, how about yourself?
In terms of what's coming out, I mean, I don't know. I can't get myself that excited over much on home video or in theaters, unfortunately. I feel like just looking at the list, there's a whole lot coming out this week. There's The Innkeepers, which I've heard some good things about. Pariah, which I've also heard is good. Otherwise, it's like last week where it's pretty thin. There's Contraband.
Contraband.
Yeah. I kind of feel the same way. I heard some good things about Innkeepers. I did see Return, starring Linda Cardellini. I had a chance to interview the director on that. It's a good film. You know, but honestly,
it's got Michael Shannon.
It does, and Michael Shannon should be seen in everything he's in.
Yeah, I want to check that out, actually.
Yeah. So I guess that for the things that I've seen, that would be the one I'd tell you to go out and see. For the things I haven't seen, but might be, you know, an interesting kind of crazy time, The Wicker Tree, the kind of spiritual sequel to the original non-Nicolas Cage version of The Wicker Man, is hitting DVD. So I really want to see that, and I can't, you know, vouch for its quality, but it could be good. Don't take my word on it. I have no reason to recommend it outside of the fact that it's a curiosity, but I'd say go for that. That brings us to the end of the Film Stage show. As always, if you have any questions, comments, if you want to voice any opinions on anything we've said, we welcome your commentary, and you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And now, before we sign off, let's see where else you can find us online. Danny?
You can find me at twitter.com/thekingbulletin or thekingbulletin.com.
And Nick?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and at thefilmstage.com.
And I can be found on Twitter at twitter.com/BrianJRowan, Brian with an I. And I also maintain a personal blog, dearfilm.net. All right. So thanks again, gentlemen, for joining me. And let's say goodbye. Bye.
Goodbye.
See ya.